Lifestyle is medicine when done right, especially food choices. It has the potential to eliminate 80% of chronic disease. Our mission is to be the trusted signal of truth based on the weight of the evidence that rises above the deafening noise of misinformation.
We offer you a no-nonsense and enjoyable approach to the fundamentals of nutrition and wellness. Our goal is to give you simple and actionable strategies so you can make smart, health-promoting decisions every day. Welcome to the True Health Revealed podcast. I'm your host, registered dietitian nutritionist Kathleen Zellman, and today I'm delighted to be joined by my co-host, Dr. Tom Rafai.
Hey, hey.
It's been a minute since we've been together, and I look forward to a fascinating discussion today with a fellow member of the True Health Initiative Board of Directors, which is our mothership, Mark Bittman. Surely you know that name. Most people recognize it. He is an award-winning powerhouse chef extraordinaire, best-selling author of more than 20 books. He's a teacher, a lecturer, a champion of culinary simplicity, but also healthy and socially responsible, guilt-free eating. So he's got lots of great common sense advice. He's been writing about food and food policy for more than 25 years. You have to check him out on his podcast. And you can find him in all forms of media. If you follow the New York Times food section, you know his column. He started that journey back in 1984 and stayed there for 30 years, creating delicious recipes, writing cookbooks, those opinion pieces. And about 20 years ago, he took a fork in the road and started focusing on food that's good for the environment and good for us and delicious. And he continues that journey. And in fact, he wrote his latest book. I think it's your latest book. You might have more after it, How to Eat. He co-authored with Dr. David Katz, who is the founder of the True Health Initiative. So I could go on and on and on, but I won't. Welcome, Mark. Thank you for joining us.
It's nice to see you. It's great to have you, Mark.
Yeah. Well, let's just kick it off by, you know, give us a snapshot of your personal journey. How'd you get into food and cooking, you know, back in the day? Was it a grandmother? Or what was your inspiration to follow this journey of food and nutrition?
I honestly don't know. I will answer that question, but I'm going to just say something about the fork in the road thing, because it's all very vague. I mean, I'm in my 70s. This has been, you know, it's getting to have been a long journey here. So, but the fork in the road thing is interesting because I was very young, in my 20s, I was a community organizer, and I wanted to make the revolution, as many of us did. And when I wound up as a recipe writer or person who taught cooking and wrote about food, I felt a little guilty, or I felt that I wasn't doing important enough work. And as the years went by, I came to realize that teaching people how to cook and how to deal with good food and how to feed themselves well, as opposed to eating the crap that the industrial food system would like us to eat, was actually noble work. And I became happier about that. And then when I became more convinced that plant forward, or whatever we call them, diets were the diets of the future, and that agriculture was a big problem, a big contributor to climate change, and the way we were treating animals was bad for us and bad for the environment and obviously bad for the animals, blah, blah, blah. It didn't feel like a fork in the road to me. It felt like an evolution. It felt like a graduation, and or really not even a graduation, just following a natural path. So I don't mean to pick on something you said, but it's something I've been thinking about, and it's interesting to me. And as for how I got started, I honestly don't know. And I've been giving it a lot of thought, because I'm working on what's going to be a memoir. And I have never had a good answer to that question. I used to make a joke and say I started cooking out of self-defense, because the food where I was living, which was in Worcester, Massachusetts, was so bad that I had no other choice. But obviously not everybody who went to Clark became a food writer. And there's nothing in my childhood that you can look at and say, here was a person who was, there was no such career as being a food writer when I was a child. There was no way to even think about it. And I just am thankful that I did have one grandmother who really cooked well, and a grandfather who thought food mattered, but not so much more than other people. And I think I was lucky that I grew up in Manhattan, where I was really exposed to a lot of different foods, which many people who grew up in the 50s and 60s were not.
You know, well, the human condition is enough to just become, you know, passionate about food. It's so essential to surviving. And one way or the other, Mark, you've evolved towards what seems to us, and we've got three on the line here, if you will, a flexitarian or a plant-predominant flexitarian, a sustainable and a minimalist approach to doing so that seems to reverberate with more and more people. Surveys have been done, and when asked if they want to go more plant rich, you know, vegan, so on, except flexitarian, that discipline without extremism approach seems to really stand out. Maybe a little bit about how you got to your plant predominant flexitarian approach and minimizing, and maybe a little bit about and how much you do have. Little crap, by the way, we define that in our medical program as CRRAHP, calorie rich, refined, and highly processed. But it still sounds like crap. Please go ahead.
I love that. Remind me. You know, I wish we were more successful. I think that's the first thing. Every day I have this conversation about how there is lip service about plant-forward diets, and people will say things like, well, I'm trying to be a vegan, but I'm failing. And it's as if we're just not doing, and we collectively are somehow not doing a good enough job of branding or selling plant-forward eating, because people do understand that it makes sense, but that doesn't mean that they're acting on it. And, you know, we all know that the numbers continue to move in the wrong direction, and that's depressing. But for me, I do think there were two moments, and this I can identify a little more clearly. I wrote How to Cook Everything. It was published in 1998. And I think right about then, I thought, I really don't know enough about whole grains, all the vegetables that are available, all the plant. And this is really so obviously the food of the future. And so that's when I decided to write How to Cook Everything Vegetarian. So I then had the opportunity to spend whatever it was, 2 or 3 years, heavily researching and cooking plant forward food. So that was one thing. But then several years after that, let's say 2005, 2007, I was in my mid 50s. My blood numbers, all of my numbers, which had always been pretty good, started to go in the wrong direction. And at the same time, there was starting to be literature about the impact of industrial animal production on climate, so that it was more than just, oh, saturated fat is bad, which of course we don't say as much anymore, but we were saying all the time back then. It was also, animal production is a big contributor to climate, the way we're doing animal production is a big contributor to climate change. So this sort of was this confluence of my diet, seeing what the future would look like, and this kind of immediacy of how are we going to scale back greenhouse gas production. And that really was the transitional moment for me. And it's when I quote unquote invented VB6. I mean, I did invent the name, but obviously it's just part-time veganism or extremely plant forward eating or whatever you want to call it. But also when I started pushing the New York Times to let me write about food in a much more serious way. And that really happened between 2005 and 2010 and culminated in my getting the opinion column, really demanding that I have an opinion column, but successfully demanding to write about issues in food that were about food as related to climate change, food as related to nutrition, food as related to animal welfare, food is related to all of these things. And, you know, that was probably the most intense period of my career, 2010 to 2015.
Well, that's fabulous. And I think, you know, when we talk about sustainable agriculture. It's not easily understood, nor is the term plant forward. I think a lot of people are interested in doing it, know that food as medicine really has a place in your life, the power's on your plate, but how do you do it? How do you eat more beans or tofu? So what kinds of advice do you have for people who are trying to get out there, trying to do this flexitarian? Because I think we all agree that doing vegan is tough. I mean, feel free, have at it, but it's a little bit more difficult when you totally eliminate all animal products. So you're the chef with great ideas. Give us some good actionable things that people can do at home to start working towards a more plant-based diet.
Yeah, for the beginners.
Yes. Yeah.
I think there's more than one answer to that question. And I know I've already given you a couple of long answers, and this is going to be another one. First of all, I think that there's absolutely no reason to see veganism as this holy grail. And to see yourself as a failure if you're not a vegan. We all know that there's a spectrum, or at least all of us on this call know there's a spectrum, yep, but most agreed. People know there's a spectrum between the supersize me diet and veganism. And all that's important is that we move on the spectrum towards eating more plants. And seeing yourself as a failure if you're somehow not a vegan, that's a very American thing to do. You know, we're saints or sinners, right? Where there's no mm-hmm. in between for us. And B, it sets yourself up for failure. Because if you think I'm only going to eat pure, I'm only going to eat clean, I'm only going to eat vegan, and then you fail to do that, you think, oh, well, damn it, I'm a failure again. I'm going to go have a double cheeseburger. And there is a middle ground, and it's the middle ground where people live and where we need to live. We just need to live. We need to shift where we are in that middle ground. So I think that's one very important thing to say.
Mm-hmm. Awareness.
The second is that the more that you have control over your diet, the more you can have control over your diet. And what I'm saying is, if you are able to eat at home, if you are able to shop for yourself, if you are able to cook for yourself, you are already so far ahead of the game. It's incredible. So from that position, if you have control over what you eat, and then you make some rules, only have whole grains and berries for breakfast. I'm going to only have salads for lunch. I'm going to only have quarter pound servings of animal products at dinner. Whatever rules you want to make. I mean, they're kind of arbitrary, but anyone who needs rules can find them or ask me. I'll give you some rules. I mean,
you need a plan. You need a plan. Absolutely.
Actually, I've been meaning to call David Katz and talk about this, because I think it's funny that now 2 out of every 3 people I meet tell me they're intermittent fasting. And I don't think there's any magic about intermittent fasting. I think it just means you're eating less.
Less is good.
Let me introduce you to flexible fasting.
I have no problem with intermittent fasting. Whatever works for you to get you to eat less crap or junk or ultra processed food, whatever you want to call it, and fewer animal products, whatever puts you in that world is great. But I need to say this third thing, and I know you know it, but it's really important. We don't all have control over it. We're not all able to shop for mm-hmm. ourselves. We're not all able to do our own cooking. We are not all able to gain control over our diets, whether for reasons of time or reasons of money or reasons of ableness, or there's 20 different reasons why you might not be able to do everything that I just suggested. And most people are in that boat, are in the I can't control, I don't have control over my diet boat. So what has to happen then is the longer term, the long game. And the long game is changing agriculture, changing food policy, making it so that the food that we know to be better for us and better for the environment and better in so many ways is the food that's more commonly grown. You know, I don't throw around a lot of statistics, but the one that I do throw around is a relatively new number, and that number is 60%. And it's that 60% of our calories, 60% of the calories produced in the United States wind up as in the form of ultra-processed food or what you, Tom, just called crap. And
newly defined.
That means either that all of us are getting 60% of our calories from that kind of food, or that 60% of us are getting 100% of our calories from that kind of food. We know that it's somewhere in between. All of us eat some junk food, and some of us eat mostly junk food. And some of that indeed is an issue of demand, but much of it is an issue of availability and supply and affordability and access and so on. If you don't have a lot of money and you don't have a lot of time and you need to eat fast and you need to get it done, the chances of you eating ultra-processed food are so high. And we all experience that every time we go to an airport and start traveling or even start driving down the road. We know that if we're going to wind up eating something, it's likely to not be good for us.
Let me inject some possible hope here and get down to some granular. There are things we can control, but there are things we can influence. And thirdly, of course, there are things we cannot control. And one of the things we talk about is fixed environment. I must say, in our Metro Detroit airport here, we have a wonderful Plum Market with lots of unprocessed and very minimally processed opportunities, but maybe Detroit is obviously an exception. We interviewed the VP of Food Beliefs at Panera, which obviously sells, and they admittedly say that they sell crap there too, but they are making a cool foods menu and you can tweak your orders and so forth. And being hired now as I'm still CEO of my company, Reality Meets Science, but as the medical wellness director now for Magna International, which is a $40 billion auto company and mobility company that is very interested in wellness, to the point they took a lifestyle medicine physician and said, let's put them on the inside and have carbon neutrality in terms of the vehicles they're helping build. I think we're seeing a confluence of events here as well. And so where people can start, Mark, how about your home? How is Mark Bittman's home set up for the default choice is the healthy choice? And when you travel and you're to work or in a car or before you get to the hotel, do you pull off to the side and instead of buying the $8 M&Ms in the refrigerator or whatever, what are some of those granular things that you do? Like when you travel, you favor cooking restaurants so you can order whatever the hell you want, whatever it says on the menu, doesn't matter. What are some of those down and dirty rubber hits the road, no pun intended, from Detroit?
Right.
Things that Mark Bittman does.
A Detroit saying.
That's right.
Well, at home, as I said, at home, it's super easy. But, the trick is to, I don't mean to encourage food waste, but the trick is to have a lot of food around. And much of that should be, and in my house, is in the pantry. And that means a big selection of whole grains, a big selection of legumes, and a big selection of things to flavor those with. And then a refrigerator that has lots of vegetables, obviously, and some that are long keeping and some that are short keeping, and just to try to favor that stuff. But as I said, at home, it's easier. On the road, I will say, I'm not going to disagree with you. I'm going to say it does fall into that category of things that we can influence, but it's borderline of things we have no control over, because for every good market you name in Detroit Metro Airport, I can name 500 terrible markets in every airport around the country. And so some people get to go to an airport where maybe they have the time and the money to go buy the good stuff, but most of us are scrambling. I've written about this, and I've written about it in some detail. And some of the most fun I've had is challenging myself to be out on the road and eat well. And you know how to do this because you said it already. But instead of going straight to the hotel, or instead of driving 6 hours nonstop and driving through a drive-through in order to keep driving, if you go to a supermarket first, you can find plenty of stuff that you can eat, on the spot without much trouble. And that's good and good for you. It's not as easy, but you can drive in a car, you can fly on a plane, and you can be eating carrots or guacamole or hummus or whole grain crackers or any of other number of things and be eating pretty well. It takes a little planning, and it takes a little forethought, but that's the strategy. The strategy is to just not get stuck in a place where your only option is the drive-through.
Plan ahead. Absolutely. Well, Mark, give us your definition of overly processed food, because it's another one where, you know, I mean, obviously we couldn't eat those baby carrots if they weren't processed. Milk is processed. I mean, there are lots of foods and beverages that are minimally processed. But when you talk about overly processed foods, what is your criteria, or how can you define them so our listeners can learn how to avoid them?
You know, I think probably one of you could answer that question better, because you'd have some systematic way of stating it, but I don't, it's not recognizable as food in a natural form. I mean, an ultra processed carrot or a peeled baby carrot still looks like a carrot. Milk still right. looks like milk. I'd say one thing is it doesn't bear much or any resemblance to its original form. Another is that it doesn't exist in nature. Another is that you don't find it in a kitchen where cooking is done. Another is the number of ingredients. It's arbitrary, but you could say if it's got more than three or more than five, it's likely to be ultra processed. And I think this is the fifth, and I think these are the five that I normally would come up with. The fifth is that your grandmother, or if you're younger than me, your great-grandmother wouldn't recognize it as food. She'd say, "What the hell is that?"
And I love that.
Right. I think that's a good one, because
it is.
A lot of this food.
We can relate to that.
Yeah. Well, a lot of this food that's making us sick didn't exist, literally did not exist 100 or 125 years ago. And I think we have the choice between living on the same food that people were living on 10,000 years ago and even longer, or living and getting sick on food that was invented in the late 19th, early 20th, or through the mid 20th century. And to the extent that we choose the traditional stuff, the stuff that humans have long grown and long lived on and long relied upon, we're going to have healthy diets. I mean, you know, the catchphrase here is, every truly traditional diet is a healthy diet. It's only modern diets that are unhealthy.
Yeah, and a little bit of a story behind how CRAAP came to be. And I have to admit, I was given a mini lecture by Barbara Rolls at Penn State. I'm sure you know the author of Volumetrics. And she said, you know, Tom, it's not just the processing, it's the refinement. So I said, okay, because I used to use Jeff Novick's CRAAP, just calorie rich and processed, CRAAP. And I said, well, calorie rich, refined, and highly processed. Okay, still sounds like CRAAP. And I think when you see the fiber drop, right, the calorie density goes up. It's dried out. The potassium and minerals are extracted, and typically the sodium goes up. You've got CRAAP if it hasn't been made into a beverage calorie. And it's all over the place. And some of it tastes so exquisitely good. Look, I have a PhD in the anatomy of a Kit Kat. I got it from Mom University. She kept 5-pound boxes all around the house. I can break it out like a model plane in my mind. You know, it's take the top layer off and get the chocolate around the edges off and get the wafer in the middle. And if you tell me I can't have that, I'll just obsess about them. So a question for you, Mark, is how much, you know, we see the blue zones have about maybe 5% of their calories from CRAAP, or the Bolivian Chimane, about 5%. You know, we call it the 5% fun zone in our Flex 5, flexitarian lifestyle system. I've already admitted some of my kryptonite, right? For that freedom from guilt, right? That occasional once in a while thing, the Sardinians going crazy on Easter and Christmas, and then they go back to what they're doing before, goat herding, sheep shepherding, no guilt or anything like that. What is Mark's occasional, obviously far less than American average, just like all of us here, but not zero tolerance, not a pressure cooker without a release valve lifestyle. What's one of your fun zone? We don't call it guilty pleasure or cheat zone, or cheat, whatever. But what is a 5% fun zone moment for Mark?
I mean, I have that every day. I drink wine. I eat meat. I eat ice cream.
Sounds like my favorite food.
What's a favorite flavor?
Do any of those things. My favorite flavor.
Yeah.
I don't know if I have one. Okay. I'm not very good at favorites. I mean, mint chocolate chip.
Oh, my God.
Oh, I like that, too.
God, blast from the past. But, you know, I don't do those things every day, but I try not to be austere. I mean, I think it goes back to saying veganism is not an ideal. The ideal is to take care of yourself. And part of taking care of yourself is eating foods you love. And for better or worse, we've all grown up eating foods that we love that are not.
Don't love us back. Yeah.
Not that good for us. But, you know, you can't kill yourself over this. It's just, it's not worth it. So I don't have days that I allow myself to eat worse than others, I think. I do have celebrations like everybody else and days when I just refuse to think about what I'm eating, but they're increasingly rare because I think that the better you eat, the better you tend to eat and the worse you feel when you don't eat well. So
that's absolutely correct. And you know, there's statistics I think are worth sharing right now because the better you eat, I mean, you are what you eat. And if you eat healthfully, you really can make a difference. The global burden of disease, a report that was put out in 2019, said 1 in 5 deaths globally are due to that suboptimal diet, which is greater than any other risk factor, including tobacco. A recent study that came out this year showed that if you adopt the diet that we're talking about, the flexitarian type diet, you can add years to your life. So if you start when you're 20 years old, you can add from 10 to 13 years, but no 20-year-old is paying attention to that. But even if you're 80, you can add 3 years. So, I mean, food as medicine is really an important concept. And you personally, I read in your bio that you lost a bunch of weight because when those numbers went up, your doctor said it's time to, you know, make a change. And I mean, getting people back into the kitchen, paying attention to, you know, filling their pantries and the refrigerators, hopefully that they can, with affordable food is really going to make a difference. But I want you to wax on about food waste and being responsible in the kitchen, because that's another number that is staggering. You know, 40% of the food that's produced in the United States ends up in landfills. So we want people to cook, but we want them to cook and be responsible. So any advice that you have about reducing your carbon footprint by reducing food waste in the kitchen?
You know, I do use everything that I can from top to tip and from nose to tail and so on. I try not to waste stuff, but some waste is inevitable. I think that, you know, I've gone through periods of freezing all my vegetable trimmings and making vegetable stock, and I periodically feel passionate enough to do that. But I think that 40% of what's produced in landfill, first of all, I think that if we go back to the 60% number I was using before, there's a tremendous amount of land. The majority of land in the United States is wasted in growing food that's either being used for ethanol or being used to feed industrially raised animals or being used to turn into junk food. And that's the most serious form of food waste that there is wasting land that could be put to use growing food that's good for us and that's not as damaging to the environment. So that's the first point I would make about that. And the second, I think that 40% figure, if it's correct, then let's assume it is.
Yeah.
I don't think that very much of that is attributable to individual behavior. Now, it's certainly if you eat out a lot, portions are way too big, and we often don't wind up finishing what we order in restaurants, and that is a problem. And food is too cheap in the United States, so we often overbuy when we go to supermarkets and wind up throwing out that head of lettuce or that celery that's gone bad or that milk that's gone bad or whatever. But I think a lot of that 40% number is food that's lost in production, left in the fields, in transportation, and so on. We saw that especially during COVID, when animals were being killed because there was no market for them or they couldn't be gotten to markets.
That brings up something, Mark. I want to ask your opinion right on the spot here. So people are traveling. They eat out at restaurants. Let's just say that that's a given. You know, you try to lean towards a more scratch cooking restaurant that that will do your bidding. You still get a large portion. And you try something that we call the 1 minute halftime, because as a speed eater, and I've slowed down, nothing makes me want to hate eating more than putting my fork down and chewing 40 times. But I can one time, halfway through the meal.
Mindful eating, yeah, Tom, right?
Well, not, actually, I love the enjoyment, the passion, and not be mindful all the time. I like to actually just immerse myself in the emotional experience. But I can be mindful enough to stop one time, halfway, just we call it 1 minute, 1 moment, halftime, put down my fork, take a sip of water, and feel, just re-engage. Because otherwise, it could plow through the end of the plate. Then I save the other half. I save the other half for later, intentionally, if I'm truly not hungry. If I'm hungry at that point, I'll eat a little more, but I typically end up with a nice snack for later.
A lot of people do that strategically. They go out to eat, planning to bring things home and have dinner for two nights. And I think that's brilliant. Another strategy in restaurants that I often adopt and that I think makes a lot of sense is ordering sequentially and just saying, we're going to have appetizers and then we'll get back to you. And if you order an appetizer per person, you are never going to wind up ordering a main course per person. You'll wind up sharing main courses because we all know we're full after, you know, after eating appetizers. So there is that too. But again, I really want to avoid blaming the victim here and saying food waste, of course, is to some extent a personal responsibility, but so much is wrong with the way food is produced in the United States, including the amount that's wasted, we really have to look upstream for a solution to this problem.
What do you, any thoughts regarding how we subsidize grains and just the whole farm bill and, you know, 30% of our arable land just goes to corn. And like you said, it's not mostly corn on the cob. It's feed and it's ethanol. And
corn on the cob is probably 1% of the corn.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what about, you know, government policy that can start to nudge along with hopefully a more interested consumer base that starts to shift choices so that these little things like Cool Foods at Panera and these little signs of hope, they sell oatmeal at McDonald's and whatever, can start to grow more. How about on that policy end?
Well, I think the simplest thing to say about this is we have spent 135 years roughly subsidizing the production of food that's not good for us, subsidizing agriculture that damages the environment, subsidizing agriculture that focuses more on yield than on producing the most nourishing food possible. And it would be a difficult change, but ultimately just as easy to subsidize the production of good food as it is to subsidize the production of crap. So long term, that's what has to happen and will happen, or we're facing certain disaster. Short term, I think we look at sourcing more locally. We look at sourcing more responsibly. We look at reducing pesticide and antibiotic use. We look at improving school lunches and teaching children what real food is and all the things that we all talk about all the time. I think those are changes that need to be made. Certainly, we should be cutting back on subsidization of corn and soybeans and on crops that are being used to produce junk food.
Indeed. Well, Mark, we could talk to you all day long. I want to respect your time and thank you so much for a very insightful and interesting discussion. I think that, you know, your prescription is to become aware of where food comes from and choose it intelligently and pay attention to those important things like sustainability. I think it's critical that we all just take more responsibility, and then together we might be able to move the needle and improve the health of the nation and the policies that support it. So thank you, sir.
And go buy How to Eat.
Yeah, there you go. All for right. You and David Katz.
Thank you both. Well, I just want to say, if you want more of this from me anyway, the place to go is markbittman.com. And we have a near daily newsletter. We have our own podcast, obviously, and many books that people can look at.
And that's markbittman.com. Yeah.
Yep. When we drop your episode, we'll let you know, and we'll make sure that all that's there so people can find you and all of your books, and we'll tag you on social media as well. Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me. Take care, both of you.
True pleasure, Mark.
You know, what a guy. Great. You know, I'm so thrilled that he's part of our True Health Initiative. You know, I'd like his voice more. You know, I think he really has a lot to say. And he's clearly, I mean, he's not a nutritionist. He's not a doctor. You know, he's just an advocate for healthy living and obviously an amazing chef.
We need more like that. It's wonderful to have us professionals out there. But if you don't have the real, well, I guess we're real people, but you know what I mean. If you don't have if you don't have people outside the professional realm buying in, no pun intended, then you got nothing. So Mark is a great guest, and you know, we didn't give him too much crap.
No, he loved that. He loved that. Well, it's so nice to be back with you. I mean, I know you're busy, and so this is really terrific, and I'm looking forward to some of the other ones we have planned coming up. Okay. All right, buddy.
Are we all set?
Take care.
That's a wrap. Thank you for listening to the True Health Revealed podcast. We appreciate your time and hope you'll join us again. For more information on today's episode and to subscribe to future podcasts, please visit truehealthinitiative.org. And to help us continue the fight against fake facts, please consider donating to our nonprofit True Health Initiative.